We are whistle ready at the Quick Restart Podcast. Like that? Whistle ready.
Thank you for coming back to the Quick Restart Podcast. I am Terry Foy, joined as always by Quint Kesnick. And Quint, every week it seems like we talk about how great the weekend of college lacrosse that preceded this podcast was, but this week truly was fantastic. We had overnight contests on Thursday, Friday, and Saturday to kick off the day. We had a miraculous event at a high school game on Friday afternoon that we'll touch on shortly. And more than anything else, I think you and I are overcome with a sense of gratitude coming away from the weekend and looking forward to the next 2 to 3 weeks of regular season action and turning our attention to the NCAA tournament. How are you feeling on this Monday morning?
I'm a little worn out from watching a gymnastics event yesterday. The tension and the stress from that is overwhelming. No, but what a great weekend, Terry.
Hold on. You left out a very important factor, which is you weren't just watching a random gymnastics event. You were watching a gymnastics event in which your daughter was participating. I think that ratchets up the stress level a little.
I'd rather play in overtime in a lacrosse game for like 20 years straight rather than watch your daughter on the beam. Okay. Let's move on, though. I got to watch a lot of games. I broadcast the one on Thursday, then had the rest of the weekend off, as I have 3 games this weekend. But a lot of games spread out nicely on the TV slate, which I got to watch the Denver-Georgetown game. I got to watch a game on Friday night. I got to watch the Maryland game on Sunday. So I love the way these games are spread out, the menu, the way it's a buffet, and everybody's not online at the same time. So that's a huge plus. There's some really close games this weekend in a year that's been kind of defined by blowout wins. We had all sorts of overtime games and close games. And then in each of the leagues, I thought there were key games that kind of set the table for the next 2 weeks.
If you were watching Penn State's overtime victory against Michigan on Friday night, you would have heard color commentator Mark Dixon talk about Peter Lake, a freshman defenseman at Loyola Blakefield, who was hit in the chest with a shot in the Dons' Friday evening game at home against McDonough. Mark's son, Matt, is a senior midfielder on that team and was one of the first to respond to Peter as he was in pain and struggling on the ground. It turned out, and I don't have this confirmed by first-hand account, but multiple second-hand accounts, that he did sustain a commotio cordis event. He was treated with an external defibrillator, both by the athletic training staff and a couple of physicians, including an emergency room physician who was in the crowd. He was resuscitated on the field, transported to the hospital, was held Friday and Saturday night, and then actually attended a team meeting on Sunday. There's video of that you can access on the Loyola Lacrosse Twitter account. And I just want to reiterate how remarkable this story actually is. Commotio cordis events are incredibly rare. Now, that doesn't mean that they are not very serious. Left untreated by a defibrillator, it is an electrical injury. It is a nerve-based injury that has a lot more to do with the timing of the contact to the chest than the force. And it's really just a matter of luck more than anything else. Left untreated, it is, to my knowledge, exclusively fatal. And it is how George Boyardee and Louis Ancampora both died on the field as a result of this injury. It is a horrible injury. And it is particularly top of mind for many folks because on January 1st of this year, a NOXI standard was implemented for goalie chest protectors that reinforce the area of a chest protector that is around the heart in an effort to reduce the incidence of this force being transferred to the body and then potentially creating this injury. And a new standard will be put in place for shoulder pads in January 1st of 2022. Peter was a defenseman who was stepping in front of a fast break shot and took the shot to the chest. Like I said, it is an injury that is often misunderstood in the sense that it is sometimes viewed or sometimes misinterpreted as a player who got the wind knocked out of him or another type of injury. A commotio cordis event, to my knowledge, is rectified only by external defibrillation. And as a result, if it isn't treated that way, it probably wasn't commotio cordis. So point being, incredibly rare, incredibly well handled by the folks in attendance. The player who sustained the injury is recovering well. And by virtue of all of the very, very long odds that collided together, just something that I think is accurately being described as a miracle and another reason to be so grateful on this Monday morning.
Yeah, I agree. And I would, you know, U.S. lacrosse has taken a aggressive stance here for years. Equipment, weight of the ball, rules, and youth. I think they're moving in the right direction to do their best to get rid of this.
Quint, as we transition into talking about the weekend, I think that there is a very clear theme that settles over the top of this entire conversation, which is that it's getting to be tourney time. Unlike other years, it is going to be really difficult to forecast the bracket because we simply don't know how the criteria is going to be applied given the unique scheduling challenges. We've spoken to Committee Chair Tim Leonard on this podcast already this year. Hope to speak to him again this week. Expected to find out the predetermined sites for the first round of the NCAA tournament last weekend. That did not happen. I'm told that there was a little bit of back and forth between the committees and the NCAA, so hopefully we'll hear of those sites this week. But the point being that, to me, the most important game of the weekend was Georgetown's 11-10 victory over Denver in overtime in D.C. because I think coming into this game, it was fair to describe the Hoyas as the last team in and, by definition, on the bubble. I think this win puts them more securely in the tournament field, regardless of how things shake out going forward. Gives them a little bit of insulation from bid thieving that could happen if, say, someone were to steal the Patriot League from either Lehigh or Army, who you would expect to get in at this point.
I watched this game from, I don't know, about 3 minutes to go in the first quarter through its entirety in overtime. And the whole time I'm watching, Denver was kind of leading through most of the game, and I'm watching Georgetown, and I was really impressed, and I'm saying, wow, they really look like a playoff team. In my eyes, they look better than Ohio State. They look on par with the Rutgers. They look on par with Army and Lehigh. But without a win in that game, they got nothing to stand on. So that win rules out any subjectivity, any eye test, because now they have a win of merit. Can they get more wins of merit, you know, in the Big East tournament? We'll see. And I was really impressed with the improvement I've seen, because I'd watched Georgetown play earlier in the year against Mount St. Mary's. I was a little unimpressed. They've made some changes. Dylan Watson's now the starter at that low left attack position. And he's a finisher who can, capitalize in transition and some other situations when Caraway is pressing the right side. So it's a nice little balance now. They got a righty-lefty balance. A lot of their young middies have grown up. Typically, we see how tough it is for young middies to make a contribution in February and March. They've got some guys who have kind of turned the corner and now playing with good confidence. And then the defense with Gibson Smith back, Mazzoni, Owen McElroy had two assists. And I would say his two assists are greater than Logan McNaney's one goal. McNaney's goal goes viral. McElroy's two assists were unbelievable. And in my eyes, those were the goalie plays that made me say, wow. Not a guy hitting an open net from 60 yards. So I was really impressed with Georgetown. I think this team, as I said in my column, this team's going to be here for a while. They're young. They had Will Bowen next year. I love their shorty, Zach Geddes. Like, James Riley stepped up and won all these face-offs against TD. And
The lead has been buried on this game. The fact that James Riley won 16 to 24 face-offs, picked up 9 ground balls, and won the face-off in overtime. Georgetown took 5 shots in overtime. Denver did not possess the ball offensively. I mean, the possessions were very much tilted in the Hoyas' favor.
It was plus 10
in regulation. And yeah. Georgetown scored on 10 of 33 possessions. Denver scored on 10 of 23. So to me, I feel like Riley was not only the most important factor in the outcome, the most surprising factor when you consider...
He's had a nice year, okay? He's had a really good year. He doesn't get much hype. But for him to send TD to the Pines, I turned it on at one point and I'm like, wow, this is really interesting. TD struggling turns out to be his worst game of his career. He's 4 wins, 4 of 12, and that's the worst of his career. That's amazing how good he's been. for that to be like, it's not that he's two faceoffs away from being 500. So that was amazing. And then Stathakis took the majority of the draws late in the game. And I'm wondering if TD was healthy or not, but it really led. I think it gave Georgetown a lot of confidence, aside from the extra possessions, but I think it was more of a confidence thing. When you get a guy who's a little unheralded and he steps up, in the face of that matchup, I think it gave the rest of the team a lot of juice.
So you mentioned Zach Geddes. I wrote about this game coming into this weekend as Geddes and Will Godin, the other short stick, being the folks that I really wanted to fixate on, because to me, if you want to be a bona fide contender, a national championship contender, you're going to have to win games with your defense. And as you have said many times on this podcast and elsewhere, lacrosse defense in so many respects, I mean, defense in many respects is defined by your weakest link. And in lacrosse, your weakest link is, by definition, your short sticks. They have 2 feet fewer stick to guide the player that they are guarding into a certain direction with. And as a result, they're constantly attacked. So not only do you need one guy, you need two. You need them to be able to stand up in certain matchups and not get exploited. You need them to be able to understand how to recover, because they're probably going to get slid too frequently. You need to be able to rely on them in the clearing game to leg out a lot of clears in order to make sure that you don't give needless possessions back to your opponent. You need them to help pick up ground balls on the wings of faceoffs. In this game, Georgetown didn't. They actually double pulled and brought Gibson Smith up to the wing in order to help with that. But my question for you is, you mentioned Geddes, but generally speaking, do you feel like this short stick unit for Georgetown is good enough to win a game, maybe two, in the NCAA tournament?
Yeah, they're going to be an absolute pain in the neck to play against for anybody, including these ACC teams who are so dominant this year. You know, Geddes, there was a point in the game, sideline clear, about the restraining box coming off a timeout. And I'm saying to myself, okay, let's see who Georgetown has handled the ball. And there goes Geddes, and he runs around two guys like they're standing still, clears it. And Kevin Warren then calls another timeout. But by giving the ball to Zach, it shows you who their best athlete is. There's also a shot at the end of the game when they win and the celebration is underway and the bench is running across the field to jump on McDermott, the goal scorer. Geddes starts behind the pack and actually passes every member of the team to get to McDermott first. It's like a de facto 50-yard sprint, and you can just see him bounding past his teammates. He is an absolute amazing athlete, one of the best shorties that I've seen this year. Really fundamentally sound. He sits down well. He can cross-check well. He clears it. He does everything. He's a really, really good player with a bright future. He's only a junior.
What are your takeaways for Denver going forward now they're 9-3?
Dodging, you know, the offense is good. The ball moves fast. They got guys who can shoot it. I thought Hannah looked good. I thought Ethan Walker looked good. I thought Jackson Morrow, not Morrell, was a little quiet. I thought Georgetown did a good job of just covering up their Dodgers. There's not much speed at Denver's midfield. And so, like, you're watching them, nothing comes easy. You know, it's got to be a lot of passes. It's got to be a lot of movement. They got to capitalize on an approach. Hannah's really the only guy who can edge by his man. He doesn't do it with speed. He kind of does it with size. It kind of just rolls at you. And just next thing you know, he's past your shoulders or past your hips because he's such a horse. He's a big, big kid. He had a strong game. But again, I just don't think offense comes easy for them. Not that they're not good. But it's just like you watch Carolina play and it's like, whoa, speed on the perimeter. You got to slide. You got to move. You watch, you know, Virginia play. They're such talented ball carriers. Denver's talent is not in their ball carriers. I think it's in their ball movers and their shooters.
Moving to the other end of the bubble spectrum, you mentioned this game already. Maryland 18, Ohio State 8. To me, the Buckeyes were out heading into this game. And oddly, I actually think that they're in a similar situation as they were, which is that they have a very clear path. Prior to this game, it was beat either Maryland or Rutgers in the Big Ten semifinals, and now they basically have one option left. Beat Rutgers in the Big Ten semifinals, and they have a shot. I'm not saying that they would necessarily be in. It would depend on how all the other factors played out. But in that scenario, with a Rutgers win, I think that they have a shot. In this game, they did not look like an NCAA tournament team. They didn't take advantage of the fact that through the first 15 minutes, it was tied 2-2. Maryland had turned the ball over six times. And Luke Weirman, the new faceoff specialist, who I now know, that was a callback to a podcast two or three ago, had not yet settled in. And Ohio State couldn't take advantage of it offensively. And for me, when you know, you get some goals in transition and et cetera, and you only end up with eight. That was the story. Hard to attribute the percentage of credit to Maryland's defense versus the blame to stagnancy in Ohio State's offense, but there were stretches in the second and third quarter when the game was still a little bit in the balance, and there were just no good looks coming for the Buckeyes. It wasn't about shots not getting canned. It was about looks not being generated.
Yeah, no, I've watched a lot of Ohio State. For some reason, their games have been on at a time that I could view them. And again, Tarasenko's back in the mix, makes them a much better team. But that's somewhere between 15 and 20 in my eyes. It's not between 10 and 15. And they have a resume. What's their record right now? Is it 4-5?
They're 4-5 with Penn State coming up. Yep.
They're sub 500. They got Penn State. Like, they got issues with getting to 500. They have no quality wins. You know, the Big Ten has major issues this year. It's not a pretty brand of lacrosse. I think they're a good team. I don't think they're a great team. And there was no time in that game that I said, gosh, Ohio State's a playoff caliber team and they're going to get ripped off. Like, I never said that.
At the other end of the field, Jared Bernhardt does what he has shown himself capable of doing, six goals and an assist. And the thing that stood out to me was the diversity of ways in which his goals came. I believe the first came off of a back cut where he was fed, I believe, by Kyle Long for an easy finish. This I know he had a pop in the high slot with a really nice kind of step. You notice that Jared Bernhardt falls down a lot after he either shoots or he obviously dives a ton, so you're going to end up on the ground that way. But he had one of those high shot releases, sidearm, where he fell over after he shot because he put so much mustard on the ball. He had his prototypical dodge to the dirt, and then he had probably his most highlight, eye-catching, worthy goal of the day was the speed dodge through X where he question marked back to his right hand and finished a jump shot. I think the conversation about who is the Twarton favorite and who should be the number one pick in the PLL draft has become crystallized over the course of the last couple weeks. I've had an just inordinate number of conversations with coaches, current college head and assistant coaches, who have just been so firm in their opinion that Jared Bernhardt is the best player in college lacrosse, is the best pro prospect in college lacrosse, on and on and on. That it's really surprised me, to be honest. It's not because I didn't think he was a great player. It's just the firmness with which this opinion is being held by, at this point, a dozen or more folks. And when you look at all the other things that Maryland brings to the table, I mean, the fact that they put up 18 goals, Logan Wisnowskis left for a period of time with a rolled ankle, only finished with two goals and an assist. You know, Danny Maltz had a great day. Kyle Long had a great day. But there are other guys on this team that are capable of contributing and just weren't called upon. And it didn't matter. They still put up 18 on a team that's, you know, a bubble out, but still a bubble NCAA tournament team at this point.
Yeah, and the Bernhardt point, I agree with completely. Because, again, watch tape, put the stats aside and plug in some Maryland highlights, plug in some Duke and then Carolina. And what I noticed last week covering Duke is Michael Sowers is not making very many plays when the ball's not in his stick. Ground ball totals, low. Cause turnover totals, low. Transition plays, non-existent. He made one play last week off the ball where he cut the middle and Brendan O'Neill fed him. That's like the first time I remember a play like that. All his production is coming with the ball in his stick, okay? And he's great at it. His range, his shooting is not the same as Bernhardt's, but he, you know, he's amazing around the crease, around the goal, and that's small windows, his quickness. But Bernhardt's contributions have many more layers, and all you got to do is plug in the tape. So you know, so I agree with those thoughts. I in fact think that, you know, Gray and Kavanaugh right now should be ahead of Sowers as well.
One more point on Bernhardt. In terms of how he projects within the PLL, one of the things that I think is really valuable is his versatility. compared to Jeff Teague and Michael Sowers, the two others that are being talked about as potential number one picks, neither of those guys, in my opinion, could play midfield in the PLL. Now, they could run on the box and invert, and particularly do so effectively against a short stick, but they can't be bona fide midfielders who can play at both ends of the field and dodge from up top and dodge a pull if necessary. Jared Barnhart can do those things. Now, obviously, there's questions about his desire to play football, and you know those are important factors to consider. Fortunately, he's got two brothers that play in the league. I would imagine that they are going to have a clear line of sight on his interest in playing PLL this summer. But as it relates to this year, the point that you made about his shooting range is one that I couldn't agree with more, and it goes back to the point that I was making about his how frequently he falls over after he takes these shots. He just puts so much mustard on it. You know, he's 6'3", probably 190 pounds, and he puts all of that weight, all of that force, all of that energy into the ball, and it just screams out of his stick, and he's got multiple release points. I think he's a really special player. Let's move on to talk about Duke 13, Virginia 12 in overtime on Thursday night. You called this game, and let's talk about it in context of the number one overall seed, because Notre Dame beat Duke a week ago. They've got the Blue Devils coming up on Thursday, and then they stay 2 days and play North Carolina later. Notre Dame, I think, would be another bona fide number one seed contender, and then obviously Maryland at 9-0 is another contender for the number one seed as well. You spoke earlier this year on this podcast, I believe it was actually last week, about the unfairness of putting the top two ACC teams at the number two and number three seed, instead favoring putting the Terps at the two seed more likely than not. What is it about Duke coming away from this Virginia game that makes you feel like you rank them number one in your poll, and I would assume by extension you would pick them to be the number one seed in the NCAA tournament if it were to start tomorrow?
Well, I was impressed. I've been impressed with their defense recently. If you really break down some tape, I mean, their game against Notre Dame, and they play again this Thursday, you're going to see a defense that's locked in pretty good with JT Giles Harris and Kenny Brower. I think these two guys are outstanding. The midfield defense getting better. Tyler Carpenter is a playmaker, and then Mike Adler, the goaltender, has stepped up a notch, and he was outstanding on Thursday night. He made not only some good saves, but his ball handling has gone through the roof. Okay, that was a question mark with him coming from St. Joe's. He came out of the goal. He made some ground ball plays. All his outlets were sensible. He found the wing defenders. He jammed the ball into the shorty sometimes, who was able to leg it out. Duke's clearing was critical in their win over Virginia. So I like Duke's defense going forward. I think it's going to be a low-scoring game on Thursday against Notre Dame in ACC, you know, in ACC terms. The low would be like 12 to 11, the way things are going this year. Low would be, you know, 11-10, 10-9-ish in that range, because I think both teams are going to struggle to score on Thursday. I think it's going to be a defensive battle. So I just think Duke is, you know, they look good. They still have, you know, world of improvement on offense. They're dodging Nekhai Montgomery. I don't know if he's hurt. He just didn't seem interested in trying to penetrate. I thought Brennan O'Neill had matchup advantages all night long, and Duke should have gone in that direction more and more. And then Robertson continues to be clutch. When all eyes are on O'Neill, all eyes are on Sowers, it's just Joe Robertson who's putting up great totals. And
yeah, so there's no question about Robertson. I mean, with now two game-winning overtime goals and goes for 2 and 3 in this game. And what I'm really interested in is I struggle to put my arms around it, in the sense that I wondered whether he had the ability to transition from being the goal scorer into being the ball handler, the quarterback, the initiator, the way that we saw Justin Gutterding do over the course of his career. And there were guys at Duke that had done that before him as well. And I think he has. What's interesting is obviously the role when you're doing it alongside O'Neill and Sowers and what you're asked to do. And I think that that's where I gotta be honest, like, this game is kind of like a blur already, because it feels so long ago in terms of the amount of lacrosse that I've consumed since then. But you think about it in the context of how defenses have to approach Duke offensively, and how Robertson in particular has the ability to take advantage of some of these matchup difficulties. One of the things, to your Montgomery point, I felt, in particularly in the fourth quarter, this was a game where I believe it was either there was a 9 minute stretch from like the 10 minute mark of the fourth quarter to like the 1:30 mark of the fourth quarter where no goals were scored, and Duke probably had the ball four times in there, and I think there were either two or three possessions where the attack either didn't touch the ball or certainly didn't create and wasn't asked to create a chance. And I felt like that was a high leverage opportunity where Duke really wanted to initiate from their midfield. And I find that to be an interesting strategy, not only because of what you've got talent wise, but also because of essentially the need to get O'Neal, Sowers, and Robertson each a certain amount of touches, a certain amount of dodges in order to make sure that they have their rhythm. And obviously, it didn't necessarily cost them the game, but I do wonder how that's going to be a priority in terms of balancing who's creating, who's initiating going forward. When, I mean, we all knew that there were going to be a lot of mouths to feed on this offense, and at this point, to me, it just seems like the attack is initiating with much greater efficiency and a much higher percentage than the midfield for the Blue Devils.
This game was fascinating because of the matchups, okay? Joe Robertson's a guy who can capitalize on – he's a crease man, but if you cover him with a slug, he's going to burn you. And he's picked his spots really well. I thought Owen Caputo didn't get as much dodging leverage as I would anticipate. Obviously, Nekai drew the pole. And that forces the ball into somebody else's, whether it's Denenza's stick, whether it's Lowry's stick. In this case, you know, Ledman scored a big goal. And then at the other end of the field – this game just like lacked defensive slides and recoveries. This was like a man-on-man game. Duke chose to short Peyton Cormier. What that did was put the ball in his stick, okay? And he had to make shots on the run. And he nearly won the game for Virginia. If you go back to that overtime, he just misses the low corner in OT as he got to the middle. But that takes Virginia out of their normal offensive flow, where he's a set shooter off of ball movement. So Ronnie Caputo, Duke does a nice job. You know, the matchups determine how the game's going to be played. And too often I think people attack shorties. The person I want to attack on each team is the worst pole, because the other team's probably not going to slide to their worst pole the way they support their shorties. Anytime a shorty gets ISO'd, it's like, okay, we're ready. We're going to go. Well, if you get a pole, many times, hey, we're not sliding to our poles, or we're slower to go to our poles. So I think that's the vulnerable matchup that offensive coordinators have to start looking at. I want to isolate against the other team's worst long pole, whether that's their LSM or their third defender, I don't know. But isolate that guy. And I think that's where you can have more success than trying to beat these shorties.
For the Cavaliers, an excellent day once again from Petey LaSala. He won 18 of 27 faceoffs, had another good day against Utah on Saturday. And you called him out as, in your opinion, the best faceoff specialist in college lacrosse right now, which Mike Sisselberger might have something to say about that, but aside from him, certainly
yeah,
something.
Sisselberger gets the faceoff against, you know, BU and Holy Cross and Lafayette. I don't know what Mike.
Not as strong a correlation between strength of schedule of faceoff guy as strength of schedule of opponent as you might anticipate. That's been true for about a decade, but moving on with
and
Cavaliers.
What kind of totals does Sisselberger have in terms of offense?
Charlie Bertrand, 3 goals. Docs, 3 goals. UVA as a team finished with 5 assists on 12 goals. And you mentioned that you saw a little bit of a return of some of their hero ball tendencies. What do you want to see from Virginia moving forward?
Well, no, it's just because the way Duke defended them.
They didn't slide.
Locked off Laviano. They really put JT on Moore and didn't support. So they were in a kind of a no slide package to their poles, and they supported their shorties. So it made Virginia, I think Virginia may have fallen into the trap a little to get away from their passing. I still think you get the ball to your best players and have them isolate regardless of who's covering who. So I would have liked to see Connor Schellenberger play a bigger role in this game. I would like to see Moore with more touches. I thought it was really, you know, Docs Aiken drew the shorty in OT, and he too nearly won the game. Miraculous saves by Adler. So he looks good. This is the best I saw Docs all year. Every 3 weeks ago, Docs is back. I don't know. He scored a big goal in that Notre Dame game. Didn't do much else. I thought in this game in particular, he had great legs. He had good explosion. He, in my eyes, looked like his old self. And he's a guy that you're not going to be able to short for the rest of the year.
Moving up to the Carrier Dome on Saturday afternoon, North Carolina 21, Syracuse 9. This was just a blottoing. There's no other way to put it. I don't know if you can do this because it's not that dissimilar from the experience that you just had a couple weeks prior against Notre Dame, but it does feel like a burn the tape and move on game if you're Syracuse. For North Carolina, Chris Gray, 2 goals and 6 assists, 12 guys scored. They had 13 assists on 21 goals, and Colin Krieg finished with 13 saves.
This baby was over at 5-0 and 9-1. And I thought that this would be Syracuse's best game of the year. I thought they had a little extra time to prepare. They had identified their weaknesses at the faceoff and on defense, and it just got worse. No DiPietro on D. Avilas, their shorty, was out. They couldn't win a faceoff. Carolina just absolutely shellacked them to the point of, I worry about Cuse going forward from this game. I worry about them getting back up off the canvas because this was such a home demolition. I mean, everybody at Carolina scored. Cole Herbert scored his first goal. The Mitty shot. I do have to give a shout out to Tucker Dordovic, who I thought competed really hard, played well in the face of a rout. But this game leaves serious questions about Syracuse going forward. You know, you can't win a faceoff. You can't make a stop. I don't know what to say.
They head to Charlottesville on April 24th, and I will say that, number one, obviously, they have a 10-goal win over the Cavaliers on February 27th in their pocket, which should give the team confidence to get up off the mat. And then the other side of this is that Syracuse loves going to Virginia, right? These games are always incredible. So those would be two sources of optimism if you're an Orange fan. They've also got another game at Notre Dame on May 1st, and the expectation is that they'll add a game the following week, given that their previously scheduled game against Utah has been canceled. But right now they're 5-4. Obviously, they've got a top 10 win. They fell outside of the IL Media Poll's top 10 for the first time all season on Monday. And yeah, serious questions, as you say, face this team, particularly relative to it's not any one thing, right? You can't give up 21 goals. You can't have the face-off performance that you had. You can't only score 9. So you got to fix every part. It's not as if you fix one part of your team and you fix everything. You have to fix every part of your team, and it's not just a little bit. You got to fix, maybe it's not a lot, but it's somewhere in between a little bit and a lot. And it's just a lot of work to do given the face of the competition that you've got over the course of the next 2 weeks.
I mean, there are a lot of issues, Terry. You know, the clearing, it seems like Orange players carried over the midfield line and then get caught in quicksand and were just harassed and double teamed, you know, once they entered the offensive zone. Timid, not clearing with confidence, not running through that initial contact. Like, I'm an athletic midfielder. You can cover me. I don't care if you're a polar. I'm just going to, in speed and space, I'm legging this one out. And that was very different for me to see Syracuse clear over the midfield line and then get ambushed and plays just blow up. Like, that's not Syracuse. That's not Syracuse. The attack can't seem to beat anybody off the dribble. Again, the middies are drawing all sorts of attention. And again, Dordovic played well. I thought Drake Porter had no chance in this game. I mean, these are time and room looks from 12 yards. I felt bad for him because that was the most goals they've given up in the Carrier Dome, ties the most in school history. Okay, there were some epic historical numbers involved in this game. This was one for the ages.
On Friday night at State College, Penn State 14, Michigan 13 in overtime. This was a game that it looked like Michigan was in control of. Late in the third quarter, Penn State went to his zone defensively, really stymied the Michigan offense. But of course, the story of the day, Mack O'Keefe, 6 goals and 2 assists, including becoming the all-time Division I goal-scoring leader, as well as netting the OT game winner on senior day. A fitting end for they've got a game left, but to this point, a good late season moment for a Nittany Lions squad that has struggled to a 3-6 season so far.
I watched on Friday. I have Michigan on Sunday playing Rutgers on ESPNU. So I had to scout Michigan. I've seen some of them. Actually, I've seen them a couple times. I thought during the play of this game, let's say the first half into the third quarter, I thought they looked good. You've been telling me Michigan has talent. Michigan has talent. And I was like looking at you like you're from Mars. I get it now. I get it. Because they do have some players. You know, that the 1-3-2 zone by Penn State, they put Fiok in the goal. He started slow. Love that kid. And he ended up making some stops. This game was kind of ugly. It was kind of like, I make a mistake, you make a mistake. So it washes it out. That was the play in the first half. It was hard to watch. I was kind of watching to scout Michigan and watch O'Keefe set the goal scoring record, which he did. Wish they had an end zone camera because, you know, one of his goals just like unbelievably pinged a corner. And then to see the final result, you know, Penn State, I thought Dan Reum made a key play late in the game. He's kind of like a energy guy for them. He'd been missing in action a little bit with some injuries. And O'Keefe was unbelievable. I'm not sure how he gets open. But then to see that team celebrate, you know, it's been a brutal year for Jeff Tambroni. This is like so far off the map from what Penn State lacrosse is. I know they got a great culture and they got a strong locker room. And this year you're not in the locker room. So things have kind of fallen off. The wheels have fallen off for Penn State. But this was maybe a turnaround moment. But I felt, I don't know, it was just so cool to watch them celebrate. Watch this team who's 3-6 jump on each other and celebrate around their star. I thought it was a great moment, a great reminder for me. Like, hey, we play games and we may be 9-0, we may be 0-9, but it still can be a special moment when we get the chance to play.
Moving along, the Colonial Athletic Association remains an absolute quagmire. Delaware comes back against Hofstra to win in overtime. The Blue Pens are now 5-1. Drexel puts a hurt on Fairfield. They are 4-2. The Pride are now 3-2. Towson, don't look now. They've won 4 of their last 5. They're 6-6 overall. Towson. They're 2-3, and they've got games against Drexel and Delaware left. UMass now 3-3, coming off of a loss in the CAA. They're 3-4 overall, coming off of a loss to the Tigers 9-6 on Saturday.
It's an unbalanced schedule, I believe, this year in the league too. So it's a little weird, I think, right?
Yeah, it is. And I mean, there were a lot of factors that went into that. And if you recall, in the fall, the CAA was the one who was the most out in front of realizing that these issues were going to be present and trying to be proactive about how they were going to address it for their conference tournaments in all sports. So to an extent, that's not a surprise. The fact that these teams will play different numbers of league games makes it feel a little bit awkward. Just means that the tournament seeding is going to be based on win percentage as opposed to based on actual record. But yeah, the Tigers, man, I mean, the point I want to make about them is last year I argued that there were very few teams. I'll say it this way. It was easy to lament the teams that were having historically good seasons, like Princeton, with respect to the season being canceled. But it was harder to feel bad for a team like Towson that had started, I believe, 0-5 before the season was shut down. And just say they missed out on their opportunity to get better and prove who they were going to become. That was the way I felt about Towson. I was like, they are, I'll use the expression leaving money on the table in the sense that they have such a strong track record of getting better over the course of the season that it felt like they were getting robbed of that opportunity. And even though it didn't cost them glory the way that it costed a program like Princeton, it still felt bad. And I think this year vindicates my opinion that that was probably going to happen last year because we've seen it happen. And when you dig into Towson's results more closely, you see that, yes, they've been the beneficiary of a couple of one-goal wins, but they also have 4 of their 6 losses are by 1 or 2 goals. So
to good teams, good teams.
Yeah, I mean, their only 2 lopsided losses are to Duke and Virginia. Aside from that, it's not unrealistic that this team could be 10-2. Now, they could also be 4-8. So it cuts both ways. But at the same time, if I'm Drexel and Delaware feeling good about myself, which I don't think Delaware is feeling good about themselves, even though they have won a couple of these games recently, I think they know that they've got some flaws they need to address. When Towson comes to town, I'm on high alert.
Yeah, this league continues to deliver. You know, Hofstra had to play two games last week. UMass is going in the wrong direction. You mentioned the Towson, the close games. You know, Drexel just keeps winning. It'll be interesting over the next 2 weeks, and I got to really check the schedule to see what the matchups are going to be. This thing could go in a ton of different directions, and so I think the only thing I struggle with all weekend were Delaware's uniforms.
I don't hate black uniforms.
Hate the black uniform.
They don't work with that
the
helmet.
Helmets and the gloves. There's so much going on.
Yeah.
Gosh.
In the NEC, St. Joe's 13, Bryant 5. The Hawks prove themselves to be in a familiar position, which is the, you know, likely number one seed. They're 6-0. They've got a game against LIU, who is 5-1 in the league, coming up this week. And then they close NEC play on April 30th against Wagner. But Taylor Ray's team, doing what they do, they probably deserve more attention. They started 0-3, and they have won six straight games to get to 6-3 overall.
You called us last week, Terry, when I asked you about the conference, and that they put their foot down and said, no, this is going to be our league right now. We're like Richmond has done in the SoCon, looks like St. Joe's has done. So that was my biggest takeaway, like, of potential league races. Maybe this isn't a potential league race, because that's quite a win over Bryant.
Well, it's not a race in the sense of what happens in the regular season, but given the Hawks' track record in the postseason and the NEC tournament, it will be very much a race to pay attention to in the second week in May. Well, yeah, whatever. I don't know. I don't even know. I don't know when these conference tournaments are. I assume they're all like May 6th, 7th, 8th.
But May 6th and 8th, I know, for the CAA, but I got to check.
I mean, yeah, there are a couple, I think, that are earlier than that. Whatever. We'll figure it out. The postponement of the week was Albany versus Vermont, the rematch. And as a result, I feel like we don't know any more about the America East. Stony Brook is 6-1 in the league. UMBC is 5-2. Albany is 4-2. Vermont is 5-1. Then there's a gap. Binghamton is 3-4, having lost to the Seawolves by more than 10 goals on Friday afternoon. The tragedy of the week was and remains Marist, who has not played since their season opening game in mid-March, and I heard some rumblings that they might be able to play this week, so keep your eyes peeled for that one. Quint, any other thoughts on the weekend action that we didn't get to?
No, I think it's a good week coming up going forward. We got 6 TV games, I believe. I got a huge week with the Thursday night game, Notre Dame, Duke rematch, 7 o'clock ACC Network. Saturday got Maryland Hopkins. There's certainly a lot to talk about there in terms of Maryland and how they look overall in comparison to some of these ACC teams. The Hopkins program under first-year coach Peter Milliman's kind of bottomed out right now. What can he do to turn things around and to rebuild the Blue Jays? And then Sunday, Rutgers, Michigan, looking for, you know, Rutgers got a hold serve there. There's a lot of TV games. I think the Army-Navy game is really interesting. I think Navy kind of gets ripped off not being able to compete in the Patriot League tournament. I think it's a really good young Navy team that I'm excited. My brother went there, class of 82. I watched two of the most impactful games that I ever watched when I was in, fifth and sixth grade, going up to watch Army-Navy at Mikey Stadium. One was an NCAA quarterfinal game. Both were, like, life-changing moments in terms of my dreams of lacrosse. So Army-Navy in Navy Marine Corps Stadium. Tickets on sale. They're going to sell 17,000 tickets. So if you want to actually go to a game in person and bring somebody with you, like, this is a game that I would take, like, anybody to and know confidently that you're going to be entertained.
I couldn't have said it better with respect to Navy's improvement over the course of the season. I watched a good portion of their game against Loyola. The Greyhounds came back down the stretch, but I thought that Navy showed good resilience in order to overcome that comeback, score the game's last two goals. The forecast for the Army-Navy game is high in the mid-60s, a chance of rain, but maybe that'll just make for more drama. I've been to a couple of Army-Navy rain games, and it certainly does when you see the mids throw on their rain garb. I agree with you. I remember thinking back to this weekend last year, after the season had been canceled, Army and Navy had been more aggressive than most in keeping students on campus or whatever the case may be. It just felt like there was the most slim potential I guess it wasn't this time last year. It was like mid-March when the season had just been canceled, of potentially trying to salvage that game for those seniors. And obviously it didn't happen. The ability to bring that back around and reflect on the fact that we didn't have a 2020 season and once again savor the gratitude of what we've been able to watch unfold over the course of the last 10 weeks is something very, very special. Quint, last week we solicited questions from Twitter users. We did not do so this week, but there was a good question we didn't get to last week. And I think it's a great way to end this podcast because I think it sets the table for all the conversations that we're going to have over the course of the next 4, 5, 6, 7 weeks. It's from Wesley Milliken, and he asked, what is your definition of a national championship level team culture? Attributes, examples, what players or coaches have to do to create and maintain them through the season, and who do you believe has that in Division I today?
Well, I think there's a lot of outstanding cultures in Division I lacrosse. You know, the pursuit of excellence was something that I always had as an individual, and we had as a unit and a team, where in comparison to other programs, I always wanted to be the, when I took the field and shook hands with the other goalie, all I wanted to say was, I've worked harder than you and I deserve to win. That's all you can do. And so that means doing the extra things, getting to practice early, staying late. It means focus on diet, nutrition, and sleep. It means not going over the top on Saturday night after a big win. It means behaving on Sunday and doing something extra on Sunday, whether it be yoga, weightlifting, a light jog, or watching some tape, you know, putting your days off to use. It means the highest possible standard by your assistant coaches in terms of building relationships with the student athletes, doing their best to give the team an advantage, doing their best to read the team, and catering to their needs that week to put them in position to deliver a peak performance. And then it's, you know, about being a great person off the field on campus and being such that folks want to come watch you play. You know, being that there's good energy and mojo behind the program. I liked what I saw at Georgetown this week, for instance. You had some students
that was awesome.
Sitting behind the fence.
That was awesome.
Painted. Like, that shows me that those kids are being good kids on campus and they have supporters and they have fans. Like, that's a great sign. That's a great sign. So those are some things. Again, and you got to have fun. Got to keep it fun. You got to develop a culture where working hard is fun.
I want to attack this question with two concrete examples that I think illustrate two different, quasi-different approaches that yield similar results. But first, I also want to reject a little bit of the premise. To me, a team culture has nothing to do with the national championship. I think that you more likely than not need to have a positive culture in order to win a championship. But I also think that there are enough examples of teams that had, I don't want to say bad cultures, but had cultural problems over the course of that season and were able to overcome them in order to win championships. Now, true, that's a great thing that should be celebrated, but that's not what I'm going to talk about. That is not the aspiration. I think that a positive team culture is year-to-year continuity where the standard is understood from the best player on the team to the worst player on the team, and everybody shares a pretty much equal role in maintaining and perpetuating the culture. And on one end of the spectrum, I think Yale does as good or better of a job as anybody and any team in the country of having that culture come from the players. Meaning that one of the things that's so interesting about Yale is, so it's one of the most elite universities in the world. It's like 4,000, 5,000 undergrads in New Haven, Connecticut, which is in and of itself a interesting place in the sense that as a city, it's not very nice, but as a campus, it's got this kind of, you know, it's intersected with the city, but it's not, you know, it's not like walled off the way some college campuses are. But at the same time, once you're on, like, in the actual grounds of the campus, it's like idyllic. The point I'm getting at is that the general student body is incredibly accomplished, incredibly ambitious, but also pretty socially oriented, right? Like, being successful socially is important. It would be easy, and I think that this was the culture that persists at a lot of Ivy League schools, and I think one that Andy Shea inherited and worked really hard to diminish, is almost working hard and trying to be good at lacrosse is not cool. You have to kind of beat that out of the existing culture and make all of the necessary sacrifices in order to be potentially the best player that you could be, cool. And I think that over the course of the last decade, Andy has done a nice job of bringing in guys who understood that, were willing to make all of the sacrifices up front of appearing not cool, and then showing their peers who don't play lacrosse, and also the younger teammates who maybe might be susceptible to thinking that trying hard is not cool, that they were wrong and that the rewards are worth the sacrifices. And now I think it gets perpetuated from the players top down. At the other end of the spectrum, and I'm not saying that this is not a player-led culture, but I thought it was really interesting on the broadcast on Sunday night when Joe B. and Mark Dixon were talking about the relationship dynamic between Jared Bernhardt and Logan Wisnowskis, and they said something to the effect of they can go hours without talking to each other. I think the point that they were trying to illustrate is that their bond is through lacrosse. I think Maryland exists at a different point on the spectrum where you go to Maryland because lacrosse is the most important thing to you. It is your life. And as a result, not going out on the weekends is not a sacrifice. It's what you would prefer to do because what you care about is lacrosse. And I think that part of a championship culture, part of a quality culture, is matching the personalities and the types of individuals that you're bringing in to the setting that you're bringing them into, and then figuring out a way to marry those two things, point it in the direction of success, and then figure out a way where it doesn't, as a coach, always have to be you telling this group of 40 or 50 individuals, this is what we've got to do to be successful. To me, that's championship level culture, and I think John Tillman and Andy Shea have done two of the better jobs, and there are many, many others, but I think those guys have done two of the better jobs of creating a culture that has a perpetual energy and a professional motion such that it's not reinventing the wheel every single year when 25% of your roster gets turned over. Quint, that'll do it for this edition of the Quick Restart Podcast. Thank you for listening. As always, if you like what you heard, leave a rating and a review. We've had a couple of ratings over the course of the last couple weeks that were pretty funny. So appreciate those. Keep them coming. Tell a friend, and we are hitting new numbers as far as podcast listeners are concerned. So we are excited as the season continues to go along by all of the new listeners coming our way. Quint, you mentioned a lot of lacrosse on TV. Make sure to follow us on Twitter. He's at Q Kesnick. I'm at Terrence Foy. We will keep you apprised of all the games that you've got to stay attention to, or got to stay tuned into, in order to be able to listen to this podcast last week and really enjoy being along for the ride.
I thought last week's show was a solid A. This week I give us a B+. We are whistle ready at the Quick Restart Podcast. Like that? Whistle ready.